All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we've got Mr. Tom Shepstone on the line with us. Of course, you can check him out on Substack. And Stephen Hines is with us too, the Word Merchant. And gentlemen, how are we doing today?
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Today's program is going to be kind of a little bit different, actually. I've never done this in the world of energy or politics. I've only done this in sports or professional wrestling, where you get your Mount Rushmore and you say, who's the top four quarterbacks of all time? Who's the best heavyweight champion of all time? And you put up your Mount Rushmore type thing. We're going to do that today with Tom Shepstone and Stephen Hines with energy enemies, energy agitators, those individuals who are trying to shut down the energy industry. And it could be from a variety of different reasons, angles. You know, who knows? It could be someone as obvious as a Greta Thunberg, or it could be somebody within the industry itself. We're going to give you, looks like 12 different energy agitators, energy enemies, if you will, today on our different Mount Rushmores. And of course, that of, you know, this is not anything I'm going to hold any of you to, you know, I'm not going to document this and hold it over your feet, so to speak, Tom. You know what I mean? I mean, this is kind of a little bit fluid here a little bit, but yeah, how you doing? And have you ever done anything like this when it comes to energy agitators?
Not really, but I have on my blog over the years a couple of times identified what I call plutocrats and poverty keepers, who are, you know, are, you might say, the enemies of energy, but very specific forms of energy. They're not against the solar. They're not against wind. They're not against geothermal. They're only against oil and gas, coal, and occasionally nuclear.
Well, Stephen Hines, have you ever done anything like this where you've had to group together those that you think are kind of causing some issue with the energy industry?
Well, yes, Jason. Over the last 4 or 5 months, I've aggregated a list of photographs and people that I consider to be, let's say, against some kind of global economic development and abundance for energy for everybody. They're very localized, small-minded sort of attacks on gas and oil, like Tom said. But the truth is, they don't really, their scope isn't large. And so in some ways, they're very easy to point out.
Well, let's just start with an easy one that I'll be up front. It's on my list. I would put her on the Mount Rushmore of energy agitators or energy enemies. And Tom, we'll start with you. I'm not sure if Greta Thunberg is on your list or not, but she's on mine.
Not really on mine. To me, you got to follow the money. It's always, always, always the money. And if you look at the money, there are two names that immediately come to mind. And I'll just give you one of them to start with. One is Nathaniel Simons. Nathaniel Simons is the son of Jim Simons. Jim Simons is a world-class famous mathematician who made a fortune on Wall Street because of his mathematical skills. And his son, Nathaniel, is, of course, a trust funder type, but also has apparently inherited some of his father's acumen and has done some of the same things. But, of course, he started with money. So, and he has a wife whose name I can't recall at the moment. But Nathaniel Simons, he and his wife, from 2008 through 2018, which is the latest figures that you'll find on the Institute for Energy Research site, they have what they call a big green list. They don't maintain it up to date as much as I'd like, but it's a really excellent resource. And if you look at those for that decade, Nathaniel Simons and his wife spent, $423 million. Maybe it was 73. Anyway, it was close to $500 million. $500 million on various donations, all tax exempt donations to all sorts of, you know, radical groups that, of course, attack energy and are kind of the first line of the energy enemy offense. But it's really, you know, the ideologues are not the real obstacle. You know, nobody takes Greta Thunberg seriously. But what she is and so many others are representatives of the people with big money. And Nathaniel Simons is one of those. And of course, he lives a life that's completely counter to everything his groups impose or want to impose on everybody else. He has a magnificent mansion in Hawaii on the beach. And he has a magnificent mansion in, I think it's either San Francisco or Oakland. And he's living the high life, you know. So Nathaniel Simons would be the top on my list, but there's another one I'll get to, and because I think we're going to go round and round here. I'll be ready with another one. But Nathaniel
All right.
is up
Stephen
there.
Hines, have you ever, Tom, I have not heard of Nathaniel Simon. I had no idea who he was. And this is why you're on the program, is to talk okay. about these types of individuals. This is fantastic. Stephen Hines, have you ever heard of this Nathaniel Simon?
You know, I haven't, which is sort of a credit to him hiding behind what they call dark money and being behind so yeah. that the average reader, somebody who isn't as close to it as Tom Sierpton, knows nothing about him.
That's correct. Yeah.
You know, and one of the reasons because I'm pretty sure I know who Stephen Hines is going to name here in just a second as his number one. And I'll tell you the reason I went with Greta Thunberg in just a moment here is because what she represents is she's almost like more of a mascot. She represents
right.
just a giant group of ideological, you know, people that are living in a planet of platitudes type of a thing. And in Fargo, we've got a giant mural of her in downtown Fargo, reminding everybody that, you know, Gen Z does not like oil and gas, and Gen Z, you know, that type of thing. And so when I see these types of symbolism, this type of just representation, for me, that's why I have her on there. And but to be fair to what Tom's getting at, she's funded by people like Nathaniel Simon. So what Tom's bringing in is the money part. Steve, have you done much with Greta Thunberg? Do you think she's anything of value, or who have you got on your Mount Rushmore?
Well, first of all, Greta, she's, you know, sort of an intellectual lightweight, and it's just been, the proverbial show of the youth telling the adults how they should lead life, which is really silly in its own right. I'm going to haul out a guy who is going to be retiring soon, but who deserves to be kicked in the shins one more time. And that's John Kerry.
Oh,
yeah.
The climate czar himself.
Well, he's in that same category with those people with a lot of money who are doing one thing and preaching another. John Kerry, while he is traveling the world, I don't get the feeling he's ever gone to South America or to Asia or to Africa and gone out into the countryside and see how people live. One of the things that I admire most about two of the latest documentarians, Scott Ticker and Robert Bryce, they take the camera and they take you right out into the countryside where they live with little or no energy, where they have lives that are completely different than ours. And they have, especially for women out in the outreaches of society, they're the most affected, because if you don't have electricity, you have to do everything by hand. And guess who does that? But anyway, John Kerry is, you know, he's, I wish I had as many words as I think in my head right now to tell you how how wrong-headed he's been, and he can't get out of the public's eye too quickly for me.
Tom, I'm not sure if you have John Kerry on your list. I do not, but he definitely is very influential when it comes to global policy. Did you have anybody like that on your list, Tom?
No, and I politicians in my and he's a politician, he's a phony. I again, they follow the money. It's like the old story of politics follows culture, and I believe in that 100%. And I think the same thing with the politics follows money too. So everything follows money, unfortunately, and there's good reasons for that, but that's where you have to look for where the evil is. And are you ready for me to give a second name or
I sure am.
okay. Well, my second name is actually a family, the Rockefeller family.
Oh, yeah.
And their tentacles spread throughout the world, China, Africa, everywhere. And they are the classic trust funders, John D. Rockefeller left a fortune like none other, and he that has gone down through the now the fifth, sixth, maybe even the seventh generation. I'm not sure how far, but I know the fourth generation is people like David Rockefeller Jr. And then Stephen Clark Rockefeller and his son. That would be the fifth generation, and they're all involved to a huge, huge, huge extent in influencing events worldwide. There was a lady, I forget her name now, it's on my website, but she identified them with something called strategic parkification. And by that she meant the Rockefellers have made it a habit to accumulate land in numerous places, either in their own name or in the public name, for their own enjoyment and use, to generate more money. So, and they are still trying to make money in a big way, and everything they do is geared toward enhancing their own riches. They have been involved in the most recently in behind the scenes in orchestrating the Biden LNG pause. There's been articles written about that, and they have had huge influence in New York. I mean, New York doesn't do anything that the Rockefellers don't approve of. Nothing. That's why fracking didn't get approved in New York, because the Open Space Institute was headed by a fellow, Joe Martens, who was a Rockefeller shill. The Open Space Institute is a spinoff of the NRDC. When Cuomo got elected, he put Joe Martens in as DEC commissioner, and he took several years to kill fracking, and then promptly went back to the Open Space Institute. That's the way it works in New York, and unfortunately, it works that way in a lot of other countries and states. The Rockefellers have enormous evil influence. I don't mind saying evil. They're not universally evil in the family. Every family has good and bad members, but the family is anti-energy to the extent, again, that they want to kill the oil and gas for two reasons. One, to assuage their guilt from having inherited all of John D's money without having done anything to earn it. And secondly, because they want to make more money. That's why they're invested in China, for example, heavily invested in China. They'd like nothing better than for China to be the preeminent state in the world, because then they'd have the ability to get in there and do everything they wish to do and make more money while also assuaging their guilt, So the Rockefellers family is, like, I would say, tied for number one in my list. Okay.
One of the interesting things that I find about the Rockefeller family is I'll go ahead and name one of the ones that I have on mine as kind of a group. And that is, I just wrote down like industry enablers, because I do think one of the biggest enemies in oil and gas and energy are those industry groups that are using the industry to personally profit. And what you just described at the Rockefellers was fantastic, because whether it's banking, whether it's real estate, whether it's politics, whether it's oil and gas, that family has historically used whatever industry for control reasons and control reasons only. And that's very dangerous in oil and gas, because oil and gas brings in a lot of tribal mentality. So if you don't like this certain industry group because you see them personally using it for their own, you know, advantageous reasons or special interests, well, then they have those resources to come back at you. And that's what the Rockefellers did for years and years and generations. I tell you what, I'm going to kind of lump that with the industry enablers and just say the Rockefellers are ground zero for that in my Mount Rushmore, because what you laid out really tackles a lot of issues that are happening within the oil and gas industry. And Stephen, you and I have had a lot of conversations about this, that there are some people within the industry that are using the industry and it's not working. It's actually having a counterintuitive effect on the education and some of the awareness they're trying to bring into the industry. Do you agree with that, Stephen Hines, or do you think the Rockefellers should be up there on the best ever for oil and gas? Because some people could consider them the best ever, you know?
Well, let me begin by saying, through a friend, I've gotten to know some of the Rockefeller family. And in fact, I've gone out to their estate for a wedding and for a party. And they had the party at their clubhouse, which is a place that has three bowling lanes, but it's enormous. So they, the truth is they definitely live large. And I have to say, watching what the Rockefellers did up in Canada, when Alberta was trying to establish more of the rights and privileges of being an owner of natural resources and being able to harvest oil and gas. But watching them throw money around has been very hard to witness, because nobody else seems to notice, Tom.
Yeah, I agree. And that their influence is so pernicious. They, for example, I spoke on a panel down in New York City one time on energy subjects, gas drilling. And of course, it was not friendly territory, but on the panel with me was a fellow by the name of Walter Hang. Walter Hang is a fellow who started his career working with Ralph Nader. And if you know anything about Ralph Nader, you know what he is. And I'm not totally against everything that Ralph Nader did, but in some respects, I admire a little bit of what he did. But the problem with Nader, what Nader turned into was a cash machine for lawyers. You know, he created these public interest groups and the public interest research groups, he called them PIRGs. And he created them all over the place. And what they were designed to lay the groundwork for lawsuits, and he was a rainmaker for the trial lawyers groups. And Walter Hang, when I spoke at this thing, he's a fellow who has some scientific credentials. He doesn't have a PhD. I forget exactly what he did have, but he became the great anti-fracking expert in New York State, and he bragged at this thing we were at together. He bragged about having the Rockefellers for a client. And that's when I first really became aware in depth of how deep their penetration went into this whole thing. They finance everybody, and they financed him to the tune of $200,000 to $300,000 a year for years and years and years to make noise in New York State. And of course, New York State, despite the fact the industry wrote them off very sadly and very foolishly, in my opinion, New York was the example for the rest of the nation. You know, once they were successful in killing fracking in New York for the time being, Then it became popular to do it in other places, and it really embellished the or it enhanced the whole anti-fracking campaign, you might say.
You know,
So.
Tom, they're using the same old fracking arguments I noticed in the media over the last couple of days because it's come back up. But they're using, old arguments. It's like they didn't want to do any more work on it. So we've already prepared it. So let's use it again. And watching what they're doing to upstate New York, the
Oh, it's
economic
terrible.
development
Terrible.
of upstate New York is embarrassing.
Well, if you read, if you go on my site, I have it up a couple different places about making a wilderness. I mean, that's what the William Rockefeller was J.D. Rockefeller's brother and his partner in business. He assembled, hundreds of thousands of acres of land in way up in the Adirondacks and basically kicked everybody else off. And that's what it's all about for them. That's one of the things it's all about. But I could talk all day on the Rockefellers, but we probably should talk about some others too.
Well, I don't know if either of you get into hockey or not, but I know that on my list, I've got a gentleman that I thought was put down back in the 90s, but he came back to life and put his hockey stick back out in public again. His name is Michael Mann, and I about soiled myself when I started seeing his name pop up in the media once again as an expert. Like I said, I thought that hockey stick graph got debunked
It did.
with I think they did it on pigeons even just to prove that anything can have that hockey stick. So Steven Hines, I know it's on your list. At least I believe it is.
Well, it's been embarrassing looking, watching that at what they call the trial, which it wasn't, because Michael Mann didn't present a case for to receive money or to have any wrongdoing for Stein and for what's his last name?
Simberg.
But watching how the major media provided the headlines, they did nothing to point out all of the flaws of Michael Mann over the last 20 years. The fact that he's really lived, his reputation have been off, has been proven, if nothing else, slight and with no reason to have some kind of eminent climate scientist position, and yet he does. I couldn't help but notice, Tom, I checked the net worth on Michael Mann. It's somewhere over $9 million. Now, does that sound like a guy who's been in academia, who was thwarted for making money by Stein and Company? None of it passes the smell test, and yet nobody seems to want to smell it.
Here's the thing. I mean, I'm a big Mark Stein fan. I have been for years. I'm a member of his club, so to speak, and subscription to it. And I like his views. He's very cynical about Western civilization, but unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion we should be cynical about it. Because it's dying, we're losing everything at this point. But the Michael Mann again, though, is just a tool. He's a tool. You can run into people like him in any area of business or academia or whatever. He's been unusually successful at his game, but that type of person, we've all dealt with that kind of person. So. The question is, who funds them? The biggest thing that came out of the trial, aside from the verdict, which was all but predictable when the opposing attorney, compared Mark Stein to election deniers, and said it's climate deniers, election deniers, they're the same people. That was the pitch that won the day with the stupid jury. But a jury, by the way, of professionals for the most part, Washington, D.C. bureaucrat professionals. So but the real thing that came out of there was when Michael Mann admitted he had not paid a dime of the expenses, which is for the trial, and he would not pay a dime. So what happened was he was used by very powerful forces to go after Mark Stein because they wanted to send a message. And the message is, don't criticize us. We've got too much at stake here. There's trillions at stake with the big green grift, as I call it. And there's too much at stake. Somebody funded him. We don't know who. I kind of have my suspicions, you know, because I noticed who was reporting, first of all, the results of the trial and all that. But it's obviously one of these big, you know, one of these big people. It's obviously somebody like the Rockefellers or a Bloomberg or the people who run DSmog blog, you know, or, that's in a whole story in itself. But there's big money involved in the whole transition, so to speak, the big green grift. And one of those people, maybe more than one, paid Michael Mann's expenses. Now think about that. The tragedy of that in terms of Western civilization, that one special interest, one moneyed special interest, can finance somebody to sue another party, an enemy, put the enemy in bankruptcy. Now that Mark Stein's going to survive, he's going to appeal, and he's, you know, he's going to survive one way or another. But the problem is, you know, any money that he ever had is now gone. Okay, any money he ever had is now gone, and the fact that he is, you know, ruined to some extent by this action shows you how unjust, totally unjust, cruel is our federal justice system, that it can be manipulated like that. It is unbelievable. It shows you we have become a corrupt country. I'm sad to say that, but it's true. And it starts with the money. Somebody funded that damn lawsuit.
Well, you know, a couple of things about Michael Mann that drive me nuts. One of them, he recently, I think maybe a decade ago, accepted an award from the University of Michigan, a free speech award. I'm not kidding you. And you know, the right of academics to speak their mind. And then he got up and made a speech about how the science was settled and there should be no more talking about what goes into the conclusion about the science is settled.
Yeah. It's amazing.
That's interesting that you said the science.
Think what he did to Judith Curry. Look what he did to Judith. If you followed any of the trial and listened to any of the reconstitution of the testimony, Ann and Phelim put it out. And if you listen to any of that, listen to what Judith Curry said. I mean, she was attacked unmercifully by this guy, cruelly. And nobody cared, you know, nobody cared.
Well, and between, you know, Roger Pilkey is in the same category.
Yeah, that's right.
Gave the most sober, clear-eyed view of what really happened. It's stunning that nobody from the other side of the debate has bothered to go to check and see the other side of the story.
They don't think they need to do that. You know, they view us with contempt. We don't deserve their attention. You know, but I think the general public, and I'll turn optimistic here for a little bit. I do think the general public is catching on that our elites are a terrible class of people. And I think, Jason, you sort of started out that way with this whole program. I mean, I when you said whatever you said, I don't remember the exact words, but I just was here, you know, silently clapping, you know. I mean, that's the problem we have.
You know, one of the things when we're talking about Michael Mann, for example, how he's just kind of ushered right to the front and these types of things. And Steve, you used the word science is settled. And I found that funny because when I did a quick Google search to take a look at that hockey stick once again and everything, that's what most of the headlines said. The science is settled. Almost like, you know, they were have to parrot the exact same thing over and over again. And of course, me being in the media, that's a red flag immediately.
Yes.
When you see the same news organization saying the exact same thing. I once had a news director tell me one time, he goes, you know, Jason, if anybody ever asks you, you know, if the media is bought off or if we have an agenda or anything like that. The only thing you ever have to just take a step back and think about this. That, what is there, four major news networks, you know, five if you want to call PBS in there. Okay, so you got four major news networks. And you ever notice we all report on the exact same thing? Big planet, huge planet. I'm sure there's all kinds of stories going on. But boy, we really do report the exact same stories. We'll give you a little bit different, but the meat's the same. And so anyway, that's what the Michael Mann thing represented to me, was more of, again, another figurehead, if you will. And I'll tell you how I got it introduced to Michael Mann was I used to interview a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ball.
Oh, yes.
And, because he was from Canada, he had this waffle flood control, flood management program. So I'd have him on my show in Fargo, North Dakota every now and then. And one time I asked him about climate change or something like that. And he uttered that famous line where he said, Michael Mann belongs in the state pen, Penn State.
Well, so he won money against Michael Mann as the suit that Michael Mann's been for 12 years. He lost. He was ordered to pay Tim Ball $220,000. And to this day, Michael Mann hasn't paid a penny.
And he won't, doesn't step his foot in Canada, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you know, if we're ever to do a program on, you know, some of the heroes, I mean, I don't know if Dr. Tim Ball would be up there, but I tell you what, when it comes to water management, oh, yes, he's definitely one of the icons up there for sure.
Are you ready for it?
Okay, I'm ready, Mr. Tom Shepstone. Let's get up. Okay, go ahead. Number three.
Number three on my list is Michael Bloomberg.
Ooh, I like that one.
This guy is, you know, extremely bright guy, did a reasonably good job as the mayor of New York, built up a fortune from nothing, and provided a valuable service. But he's again, one of these extremely uber rich people. And he, you know, has a home in Bermuda that he jets to back and forth, did that as mayor, jetted back and forth on weekends to Bermuda. And somehow, and if you remember, and Jason, you may remember this, he was in a famous debate where he talked about farmers. And he said, you know, we were moving into an information age where you needed to know so much, you know, whereas in the farming age, you just went out and put a seed in and, you know, covered it with dirt and waited for it to grow. Remember that?
Oh,
and he, you know, it was very condescending. And that's who he is. He's extremely condescending, a capable man in many respects. But he has, you know, he just the other day, I think you had it, Steve, on your Substack, I think you had a report about him donating another $500 million to the Sierra Club or something or other. And of course, he's, you know, he's literally put billions into it, like Nathaniel Simons. And I think in his case, I don't know what investments he has. I suspect he does have investments in the big green grift. But I think in his case, this is strictly about power. I mean, this is a man who, you know, why did he become mayor of New York? You know, the public answer is, you know, he saw it going to hell and he needed to save it. You know, but that wasn't true. He succeeded Rudy Giuliani, who had done a great job as mayor. He did it because his ego demanded he do it. He needed to be mayor. He wanted to be president. He has a tremendous ego. He's extremely condescending from what I read, most people around him, and certainly with respect to the average common man or woman. So I think he's done an enormous damage to our cause because he's just throwing money at it like crazy. I mean, he has the classic approach of that we talk about in the barnyard, you know, throwing enough manure against the wall, it's a little bit of it'll stick, you know. So that's what he does. And he's doing it. I don't think he's doing it extremely effectively. And I think his lack of effectiveness was belied in his, or as was shown, I should say, in his presidential campaign, which was a spectacular failure, just totally spectacular. And I think he's doing more or less the same thing, but still, look at who he's empowering and enabling, as you say, Jason. I mean, the enablers are the root of the problem here. It's always the enablers. That's my view.
Well, one thing, and the next person on my list is Al Gore.
Yeah, yes, that's
In a
true.
certain way, nobody has done as much damage to the
Yeah.
discussion on energy and the environment. And one of the things I demand of Michael Bloomberg and Al Gore is that before they say a word, that they disclose all of the conflicts of interest that they have. Because I think it would take them longer to talk about the conflicts of interest than the speech they prepared.
I think you're right.
And speaking of making money off of activities, how does Al Gore keep any credibility out there when his net worth is somewhere around a half a billion dollars? He was on the board of directors up until I think he just resigned of Apple, but he's been where he should not be talking in public, where he should be living up to his fiduciary responsibility of taking care of the money properly for anybody, any company he's with, or any company he supports.
I have a hard time arguing with you on that one.
You know, the thing about Al Gore is he's kind of a Greta Thunberg type of a symbol, if you will. He really was the ushering in of the emotional climate change. I mean, Ted
Right.
Turner tried for a long time with Captain Planet and his environmental endeavors, and even the Greenpeace founder, he tried his certain ways. I laughed when I saw an interview with the Greenpeace founder talking about how getting rid of fossil fuels is the dumbest thing he's ever heard.
Yeah.
He said it would just destroy humanity. He's like the people who are in charge of the green movement are insane. That's the founder of Greenpeace. He's talking about how this new green movement's absolutely insane. But when I look at Al Gore, to me, he ushered in the Greta Thunbergs and everybody else. That's how I view him. Tom, I don't know if he's not
Again,
on my
I
list,
do.
but.
Again, I think he's a tool of the money, but he's on a different level because it's his own money, his own investments in many cases, and as we know now, we know exactly how he's making his half billion or whatever it is, and the other thing is just by the fact that he was vice president, he was so prominent in that movie. I do have to agree, even though I always point to the money. In this case, that guy really did have an enormous effect, negative effect, no question about
And the fact that
it.
he continues to have credibility, and they allow him to speak at the international group meetings and give him credibility
Yeah.
as an environmentalist.
Right.
It just seems to me that he is nowhere near an environmentalist in any sense of the word. The other problem with him, as far as a predictor of the future, he has been. For a guy who's been wrong for the last 30 years, he still gets credibility when he says something. And
Yeah.
for the life of me, I don't understand that.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and name my fourth one, and I'm not sure how I would put this up on Mount Rushmore, but I couldn't decide if it was Leonardo DiCaprio. I couldn't decide if it was Mark Ruffalo. I couldn't decide which member of Hollywood I wanted to single out because they're all so important. I mean, they all play such a role. I'm sorry, I just was doing my Academy Award there for a second.
Yeah.
But to me, I just had to put Hollywood up there. That I view Hollywood as being a very influential, very powerful force out there. And coming off the Super Bowl, I couldn't watch the Super Bowl because I wasn't a part of the inside joke or the inside conversation that was going on because the announcers were more focused on the stuff not happening with the game that I didn't know. I had no idea what was going on. I wasn't part of their group. I was out. So football's done with me now. But that's how I kind of look at Hollywood. They kind of treat the environment like it's theirs now. And they now get to protect it on our behalf. Tom, I don't know if you view that in the same way as me or not, but your thoughts.
Well, I detest Hollywood. Or most of it, I should say. There are a few good examples, and some of them do make a positive difference. But mostly Hollywood is a joke, and I have to say I don't think they have as much influence as they'd like to think they have. You know, we all get annoyed at them. We realize how incredibly stupid they are for the most part. And if you look at the people who are watching Hollywood, it's going downhill fast. I mean, it's really going downhill. So because they've given up entertaining and gone in for something people don't want, you know, the viewership of all these shows, award shows, I guess one recently went up a little bit, but most of them are going down, you know, steadily. And I don't think people really at the end of the day intensively listen. They may pretend to listen to Hollywood, but I'm not sure they really do. I'm not convinced of that.
You know, Robert Bryce was having a conversation the other day with Emmett Penny, who is a very smart guy. I hadn't heard of, but Robert Bryce really honestly said how complicated this whole discussion is. Energy, electricity, environment, the grid,
right.
Economic development, and that at this date, now he's been doing it, as you know, for almost 25 years, Tom, and published several books and done a couple of documentaries that are remarkably good. But he admitted that he still only knew in a field of four, he only was a three because of how complicated it is on the technological side, both the science of the climate, but also on the science and the technology of the innovation that's going on as we speak. And one of the things that continue, how can a group of people expect technologists to produce a whole new market, whether it's electric vehicles or hydrogen, when they don't believe in the model, they don't know how it works, and they think they if they say a technology will do it, which of course is not the way it works.
No.
I keep saying that I think the EPA and the other agencies need to be peopled with many more engineers so they at least knew what they were talking about, the economics of all of this, and whether it's possible or not, and whether it's a good investment or not for the dollar.
Well, let's go to number four for Tom Shepstone. Who's your fourth person on the Mount Rushmore of energy agitators?
Well, it's a little bit like maybe some of your list, Jason. I would put the fourth person or fourth group as the globalist cabal, which in my mind is the UN, the World Economic Forum, the European Union, and the International Energy Association or agency. Those four groups are essentially, you know, completely united in their commitment to the energy transition, in quotes.
So the European Union, the United Nations, the International Energy Agency, and did you say the World Economic Forum is the other one?
Yes. Okay. They're all those four are linked at the hip. You know, they're all to some extent the same people.
Well, I tell you, you're just one trilateral council away from Illuminati there.
Holy yeah. What a great counter.
The Council of Foreign Relations, and we got a trifecta, man.
Yeah. But it's all the same people, and they want two things. They want power. They want a globalist government. That's always been their goal, because The Superman movie is not that far off in terms of the evil villains. What was his name?
Lex Luthor. Yeah.
Yeah, Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
And Lex Luthor is not that far off from what we're dealing with now.
It's, can I sidebar for 1 second here? Because if I were to go back in time and I grew up watching Legion of Doom and Super Friends and Spider-Man. And so, like, when I was a kid, that was 80s cartoons, man. I mean, that was, and so the Lex Luthor and the Joker were the lamest villains when I was a kid. I thought, well, what is their superpower? How stupid. But now that I'm older, those two were the most dangerous villains of all.
Of
I mean,
course,
Lex Luthor with
of
his globalist agenda, with his
course.
super intelligence of just pure evil. And then you have the Joker who's so smart and so cynical. Oh,
Well,
man.
think about the WEF with Klaus Schwab. I mean, I think Mark Stein refers to him as what the sinister Teutonic, the sinister Teutonic something or other. And it's a wonderful phrase. I wish I could remember it, but the guy just looks like he should be Lex Luthor, does he not? I mean, he
Oh,
just looks like it, and
as a an aside, Tom, net worth $170 million. Again, this is a story about people with money, and they've convinced themselves that they're virtuous, and their view of the world is the right one. And how dare anybody represent the other side because it's evil?
And
I
look at
mean,
how the
seriously.
look at the lady from the that runs the EU. She gets up and she says with a very straight, stern face, just like the classic school marm, who everybody's scared of, and she tells everybody the greatest threat we face is the threat to trust in us, disinformation. I mean, you just want to throw up when you hear it. And it's all about the elites protecting their turf and again making money, as you just illustrated with the net worth about Klaus. It's about earning ever more money and controlling the people who might stand in the way. It's control and money, power and money. It's always those two things. They're like aphrodisiacs to the elites, and that's the problem we face, and probably the world has always faced, to be honest with you, but it seems particularly acute at the moment.
Well,
And
Meredith Engwin, who you probably know, is she foresaw the problems with the grid 3 or 4 years ago. Gray-haired woman, smart, wrote a book about the fragility of the grid, which of course has
Oh,
turned out
yeah.
to be absolutely true. And we're not
Right.
we're 3 or 4 years away from even dealing with the complexity of the grid. But she
Right.
had a great line when she was on Robert Bryce's podcast. She said, "The facts are starting to intrude on the renewable, on the
Right.
globalist, or they no, the environmental narrative. The truth is starting to intrude on the environmental narrative, and that's where we are right now, Tom." What you're doing, what Jason is doing, what I'm doing is to try and say, wait a minute, it's just not true. Let's talk about it and let me bring in my experts, and then you bring in your experts. And honestly, on the other side of the argument, Tom, they don't have anybody other than Michael Mann
Well,
or
here's
James
the thing.
Hansen. These aren't experts. These aren't Judith Currys. These aren't Roger Pilkeys.
I think you're right, and we do have some good people. One of which, who's Steve Koonin, who wrote the book Unsettled. If you haven't read it, you should. He's an Obama bot, but he's a sensible Obama bot, and he wrote a wonderful book. He didn't identify the problem with the search for power and money, but he did dismiss all the typical arguments that are used to generate hysteria. And he said, look, it's not completely settled, and the bottom line is, even if it was settled, we should be he says the same thing as Judith Curdy. We should be adapting, not worrying about trying to do this crazy green transition we're talking about. So But I think my thoughts as we, I'm sure we're running out of time here, but I think what we're doing, Steve, all three of us, is we're putting out what in Russia was known during the Stalinist days was known as samizdat, which is it's little secret messages and communications among those who understand that things are wrong and really want to get the truth out, you know, and whether we put it on a note in a bottle or put it on a tiny slip of cigarette paper and stuff it in a straw and pass it, you know, that way, or we, as Mark Stein says, we have the last photocopier in the woods. All those, that's what we're doing. And if you read any of Solzhenitsyn, I've read a lot of his work. That's what he did. That's what he did. He's one of the great heroes of the Western civilization, one of the greatest of heroes. And he did it by communicating however he had to communicate. And that's what we're doing right now, you know? So that's how I see it.
Well, as we kind of wrap up here, let's go ahead and let's go through our Mount Rushmore of energy agitators, energy enemies, if you will, the ones that are seemingly having a negative impact on the energy industry. And Tom Shepstone, let's go ahead and name your four Mount Rushmore and maybe one or two sentences why.
The ones that I already gave you?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Nathaniel Simons, because of the huge amount of money he's spent on various foundations, including the energy foundations, the Rockefeller family for all their insidious efforts to block fracking in New York and undermine energy development everywhere in the world, really. Michael Bloomberg for his financing of the Sierra Club and so many other anti-energy venues. And finally, the globalist cabal, which is the UN, the World Economic Forum, the International Energy Agency, and the EU combined. It's really all the same people who are trying to steer everything in the corporatist direction. I mean, that's what we're really talking about here is corporatism. And all four of my choices involve corporatism.
Stephen Hines, what do you have for your Mount Rushmore of energy agitators?
Well, I guess first I'd have to say Al Gore. And it's pretty hard to describe how many ways Al has been bad to the global community, so I won't bother. One that we haven't talked about that really continues to worry me is regulators and regulation in the US. They're starting to speak as one voice, and it's a voice from the White House. So watching the SEC, watching EPA, watching Department of Energy, and they're all trying to change the laws through regulatory rules where they bypass Congress and Congress's rulemaking responsibility. They are maybe the most insidious of them all right now because they have their hands on who knows what, $500 million in grant money thanks to the IRA. So they have the power of the purse. They have the power of naming allies who get credit for participating and working with the regulations and the regulators. I'd have to say, and I really haven't talked much about him, but he bothers me because he has come back after 30 years and tried to establish his expertise, and that's James Hansen. Here is a guy who gave his famous speech in front of Congress, and he was sweating. If you remember the practical event, he was sweating and delivering a speech about global warming. And as the truth comes out, somebody had decided to turn off the air conditioner so it was hot in the congressional room when he spoke. Now, if there's an example of manipulating reality, I mean, that's simply impossible to imagine anything worse. And you know, the last one, I guess, simply because I guess it has to be Klaus Schwab. And I get, well, I'm going to do five. Antonio Gurtz from the UN. Those two, Karl Schwab and Gurtz, it's simply they have a place to speak daily, and they are quoted daily, and they, in a sense, establish the narrative of the day daily.
Well, mine are number one, I've got Hollywood for the representation and the way they can manipulate the emotions so easily. I mean, that's what they do as their industry is Wizard of Oz, our emotions, if you will. Greta Thunberg for representing Generation Z and the new movement, if you will. And anybody who is a 16-year-old girl and gets to usurp all the climatologists to become the head figurehead for climatology, that's some incredible power. And I know it's the people behind her, but man, I always tell people, could you imagine being the top climatologist in the world and you get to keynote the UN summit and the Paris Accord and all this stuff, and you just got bumped for a 16-year-old girl?
That's a great point. I have to admit, that's a great point.
Yeah, and then I have Michael Mann on there just because he's like Michael Myers. He just keeps coming back from the dead and getting back up there once again, and that's some powerful stuff right there. And the last one I'm going to leave us with is, and we can of course have our own opinions on this as we conclude this interview, but I have now the industry enablers, whether it's the Rockefeller family using the industry for power, whether it's some industry executive who's got some side interest that he's making sure he gets taken care of first as opposed to the industry. But I got to be honest, guys, when I take a look at Colorado, New York, California, and I see how a lot of that industry leadership has stayed the same for the last 20 years, and they're doing the same things that they've been doing for 20 years. You know, hey, let's come on out to our party and don't forget to give us some more money. And now we have states banning oil and gas. I do think we need to take a step back and say, do we have the right people in office? Do we have the right people at our industry leadership? Because I know the three of us have been promoting the oil and gas industry positively for over a decade. And I can't tell you, I can count on one hand how many of those industry leaders have reached out to us. I mean, it's not too often they do. It's more of us trying to get their attention.
Well,
And go ahead.
Jason, what you just said could also be applied to the Republican Party.
Absolutely.
I am a state committeeman in Pennsylvania, and I'm going to tell you, I've been a state committeeman since May of 2022. I ran as a friend asked me to do it for the party. The county chairman asked me to run, so I did. What a total joke the whole thing is. I mean, it is so bad. It is so behind the times. It's so incompetent. It's just so out of touch. It's unbelievable, you know. And I'm just beside myself wondering what to do about it, you know. I mean, it's
What
terrible.
about the Democrat? You know, in the theory of relativity, though, look across the aisle.
I know, I
You
know.
know, and we, you know, I think about this the other day. I mean, literally, we likely are having a presidential election with two crooks. You know, I
Well, that's
mean,
not the new there. That is not new
no,
there by any means.
but so, no, I mean, in the, in, you know, in front of the Klieg lights. In front
Well,
of the
I
world.
think what's more on point is the fact that our Congress is becoming a singular entity, that
Yeah,
there
that's
is
right.
becoming
That's right.
one thought. And
That's where
you
I
can
was
call
going.
it, you know, Republican, or what did they used to call it? Republicrats. It was the word Republican and Democrats together, or Demicans. Now they just call them rhinos or dinos. And it's Republican in name only or Democrat in name only. Right now, our state senator from North Dakota, he's actively trying to promote this carbon market to be socialized or to be fascized, depending on how you look at it, to where he's trying to make it a common thing so we are forced to pay for these projects. And of course, you know who they're going to. They're going to all the elitists.
Of course.
So yeah, here you have, you know, U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer, and you know, he campaigns on he's a traditional Republican.
He's not even close.
Most Republicans aren't stomping for socialism that I know.
it's terrible. It's terrible. Final
thoughts. Go ahead, Tom Shepstone.
I'll just say this, and I'll get out of the way here, and we'll end it. But I do have some hope. You know, my hope comes from the fact that a lot of people are noticing stuff. The common people are noticing more than ever, I think. And the second thing is, I notice that the fringes of the left and right, and I'll say, I think I consider myself a bit on the fringe of the right because I'm not a rhino, you know, I'm a conservative. But I think the conservative Republicans and the liberal Democrats have joined hands in some respect. I mean, you know, you see it in so many places with so many people, whether it's Naomi Wolf or whether it's Elon Musk or whether it's Matt Taibbi or Michael Schellenberger. Russell Brand. I mean, you see the coming together of people who are honest. That's all, just honest, and are willing to criticize what's happening. And so those two things are encouraging: the common people waking up, and the real honest left, honest right coming together and saying enough. Can't stand these people anymore, you know. So.
Well, we have, and I have hope too. Robert Bryce always asks his guests, "Well, what's at the end of the program? What gives you hope?" Well, here's what gives me hope: what's been going on in Europe on behalf of farmers and others. And we have one chance right now that is the best of all opportunities. It's at the ballot box. It is going to be taking back more than a little control from the bureaucrats and the dark money and dark organizations, and more transparency and more level-headed, good economics, good international relations, including with the European Union, which it's hard to want to help them, but they're our best hope.
Tom Shepstone, Natural Gas Now. What is your Substack page?
It's Energy Security and Freedom. Energy Security and Freedom. I rebranded it as that, and it's gone extremely well. I can't believe the interaction and the viewership on that compared to WordPress. So I'm very pleased.
Substack just really creates an opportunity like nothing ever has seen. Yeah. I mean, I was telling somebody the other day because we, with the crude life, we've had talks with multiple television stations around the Midwest.
Right.
And I just told one guy the other day who was helping me with some behind the scenes stuff. I said, you know, it'd be just as easy just to put it up on Substack and call it a day. Like, I don't even know if I want to go through the BS with this.
I know.
That's what I tell people. I go, it's like going in your own newspaper, magazine, radio, and television station just by signing up. That's it right there.
It's Samizdat too, you know. So.
Well, Stephen Hines, how can people get a hold of you then?
Well, I too am on Substack, Stephen Hines at Substack.com. I do post on LinkedIn. I do post once or twice a day on Facebook against Stephen Hines. And I also communicate through notes on Substack with other people of like interests. So not unlike both of you, I try and keep my friends, make sure we're all on the same page. We all have seen The latest news that gives us a little advantage over the anti-intellectual crowd.
My name is Jason Spies, thecrudelife.substack.com. Of course, you can go to The Crude Life, find all of our interviews there as well. Tom Shepstone, Stephen Hines, that's going to do it for our Mount Rushmore of energy agitators.